From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how Mayor Mike Duggan worked the system to increase testing supplies for the city.
Duggan is a former hospital CEO. He's well-connected within that industry, and he has some strings to pull, and he's been pulling them.
Also, the floodwaters rolling over Midland carry dangerous chemicals in a place already marred by waterborne threats.
I mean, there are a lot of different chemicals that went in there, including solvents, tars, lead, other heavy metals, fluorine, phosgene. It just goes on and on and on.
And how playwright Michael R. Jackson wrote his Pulitzer-winning ode to Black queer life. When breaking ground, it helps to believe that no one's paying attention.
I was never censoring or editing myself with how much I would say the unsayable.
Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Stay tuned. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, we'll look at some of the environmental threats unleashed by the flooding in mid-Michigan. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer today announced loosening restrictions on some Michigan businesses, including medical and dental operations, and on small gatherings just in time for the holiday weekend. But before you get ready to head out that door, we've invited Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta to detail what the governor said and what restrictions remain. Rick, hi there.
Hello.
Can you give us a little bit more information about what the governor said regarding appointments and retail at this time?
Yeah, that in retail, we're talking about car dealerships, which is certainly one that's gotten a lot of attention. And it's not that you can just go and roam the dealerships right now and check out the different colors and models, but you have to make an appointment, and it's one person at a time that, you know, all of the social distancing, face covering, those sort of restrictions are still in place. You can just now go to more places. Gatherings of 10 people or fewer are allowed, and that takes place right away. The others are going to be, basically, they're going to play out over the next couple of weeks. And the governor says that because we're having success with what's happened already, she's going to issue new orders that loosen the existing restrictions. And then we're going to wait a couple weeks and see how it goes, because that's how much time it kind of takes to see how this is going to impact the spread of COVID-19.
So if I'm getting this right, if people have outstanding non-emergency medical appointments or dental appointments, they might be able to start making those happen?
Exactly. And veterinary visits as well. But yes.
Starting next week, yes?
Starting next week.
Great. Did she give any hints as to what factors she's looking at now and what areas of concern might exist going forward?
Well, I think she did more than hint that she said that they're looking at the rates of increase, how many new cases that they're getting, where are they seeing the new cases, and how quickly is it spreading? Those are the data points that she's looking at to make these decisions about, you know, loosening restrictions on gatherings and economic activity.
Was the state's chief medical officer there with her today? Did Dr. Khaldun have any new information about hard numbers about how we're doing?
Dr. Khaldun was not there today. She had some kind of a conflict someplace else that she had to be. And so the governor instead brought some people who owned businesses that will be allowed to partially reopen, car dealership owners. And they're saying that, you know, this is the right time that they think that they're ready to reopen their businesses, even though it's on a partial basis, that everything is going to be by appointment. And the same is true of doctors, dentists, and veterinarians. They no longer have to restrict their businesses to only emergency services, but they can start to schedule non-emergency visits as well.
Was there any expression of concern about whether the pent-up demand might drive people to go out more quickly or perhaps a little bit more hastily than they absolutely need to?
Not a specific expression of concern about that specific circumstance, but certainly the governor keeps saying, be safe, be smart, practice social distancing, wear your masks, and if you don't really have to take a trip, then don't.
Rick Pluta covers the Capitol Bureau in Lansing for Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, April.
As pandemic weeks turn into pandemic months, many questions are still kind of hanging around out there about how we know what we know about COVID-19. Where is it? Who has it? Who has had it? One of the major limiting factors in testing for the virus is the availability of supplies for test kits. Michigan radio reporter Sarah Swick has been looking into this for us, and she joins us now. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, April.
We hear so much about COVID-19 test kits, but what is a test kit, really?
Well, it's kind of funny because before I really started looking into this particular story, I had already been doing a lot of reporting on testing and test kits, and I don't know that I ever actually grasped what a test kit really is before I did this. So really, it's essentially three things. It's just a swab to stick up someone's nose to take a sample to try to identify whether or not they have the virus. It's a clean vial of some kind that they can put that swab in. And then it's a liquid medium to use to transport the swab in the vial, which can be, I believe, any number of things. I'm not an expert on that, but it has to be something that won't interfere with testing on the lab end. So the PCR, polymerase chain reaction testing that they do to actually test for the virus on the lab end, it has to be something that's not going to mess up that chemical reaction. So it's just those three things, the swab, the vial, and the transport medium.
Got it. So what kind of obstacles have states and cities and institutions been running into when they're trying to get the tests?
So quite a few. So Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan has talked a lot about testing. He says he's obsessed with it and is really pushing the idea of trying to test as many people in the city as possible. And he's been pretty good in general, his administration, about securing tests for the city, relatively more successful than some others, but they've still encountered some major obstacles. So basically, back when they first were trying to order some kits, apparently they ordered 5,000 from China, but those were held up by the Food and Drug Administration. So Duggan actually talked to the head of the FDA, Dr. Stephen Hahn, and Hahn got them released. And then Duggan said this is what happened when they ordered some more test kits.
So we ordered another 20,000. They got embargoed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture at a Romulus warehouse. But Senator Debbie Stabenow stepped in, and with the federal government's help, they released the 20,000 kits.
That is just crazy. So Detroit has had, relatively speaking, some success at getting tests. Would you say that their approach has been essentially different than other places or groups that are trying to get the kits right now?
Well, I don't know if their approach has been essentially different, but the difference may be this. Duggan is a former hospital CEO. He's well-connected within that industry, and he has some strings to pull, and he's been pulling them. One of the biggest, perhaps, that he's pulled is going to Dr. Roberto Romero, who is the head of the National Institutes for Health Program for Perinatal Research and Obstetrics, which is housed in Detroit. And they do all sorts of research on high-risk pregnancies. So Duggan basically turned to them for the testing supplies that needed to open up the drive-through testing site at the former Michigan State Fairgrounds. So basically, what Romero said he did was he went to his stockpile and he had a bunch of Dacron swabs that he used for taking swabs from pregnant women. And he says those are basically the best kind of swabs to use for COVID-19 tests, and some tubes to put the swabs in. And they also found a transport liquid to protect the swab. This is what he said they actually did.
And in essence, we provided approximately 14,000 swabs with tubes and media, and they were prepared by volunteers.
So Romero and his team are still providing some test kits as needed for Detroit, but Detroit is also, you know, they're also sourcing them from other places now.
Sarah, in terms of availability overall, would you say that things are getting better out there or worse? I mean, where are we in terms of where the state would like to be with test kits?
So I talked to Dave Coulter. He is the Oakland County executive, and he told me that the testing supply situation is getting what he called incrementally better, especially on the lab end when it comes to lab capacity for actually processing these tests. But Coulter said that they need to scramble for supplies constantly, and that takes up a ton of time and bandwidth at their emergency operations center, which is basically going all full blast these days. So they're looking basically to different suppliers for the different supplies that make up the test kit, and they're just basically trying to find the stuff to assemble the kits any way they can. And Coulter said that it's also created this situation where you have all these different groups trying to get supplies and they're competing against each other.
We're not only just competing against, you know, Ohio and California, but we're competing against other nations. And so the supply chain issues have been very, very challenging.
So Coulter said that actually these swabs, which are not really high-tech things, have been one of the biggest bottlenecks in the supply chain. But basically, he says the whole thing is just kind of an inefficient mess, and that if we'd followed any kind of pandemic playbook that's out there, it would be the federal government that's at least organizing a kind of network to secure these supplies with its buying power and filter those down to the states and counties. But he said Oakland County realized pretty quickly that wasn't going to happen and that they would have to scramble for things on their own.
And wait a minute, haven't there been some issues with federal supplies even when the U.S. government does step in?
Well, it looks like there have been. Governor Whitmer said recently that the state of Michigan got a big shipment of swabs in, but they were 100% foam swabs. And there are different kinds of COVID-19 tests, and the foam swabs aren't ideal for most of those tests.
And so when our shipment from the federal government comes and it is 100% foam swabs, it means we can't execute all of these other tests that we have.
So, Sarah, would you say that when it comes down to the average person wanting to get a test, would you say that Michigan is anywhere near where it would like to be with testing on demand?
It's getting, like Dave Coulter said, incrementally more toward that point. But the state's most recent goal, they said they want to be testing 30,000 people a day, especially as we look to reopen the economy more and more people are going back to work. And we want to make sure those people don't have the virus. But we're still really not anywhere close to what public health experts think that we should be, which is the number I saw, which was at minimum somewhere around 58,000 tests a day. And it's really because of these supply chain issues and sort of that the federal government has kind of abdicated the job of trying to organize these things. So in short, yeah, things are kind of getting better for people who want to get tested. And, you know, certainly more people with a wider range of symptoms or even no symptoms can get tested, but it's not where we need to be.
It's our own reporter, Sarah Swick. You can read her write-up on access to supplies for COVID-19 test kits at MichiganRadio.org. Sarah, thank you so much.
Sure thing. Thank you.
After the break, Detroit native Michael R. Jackson talks about his Pulitzer Prize-winning work, a new play exploring life as an outsider.
Early on, I sort of decided that I needed to give myself some distance from being like, this is a story about my life.
That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Detroit native Michael R. Jackson was awarded the Pulitzer Prize this year for his off-Broadway musical, A Strange Loop. Jackson's show is a musical about a character writing a musical.
How many minutes till the end of intermission? Is that how the show should open?
Should there even be a show?
No, it should start with what he's thinking,
which is just a cursor blinking
because of all of the directions that the narrative could go.
It's an effervescent mix of traditional Broadway songs with gospel, R&B, and, if you can believe it, a heavy dose of Liz Phair. This is the first musical to win the Pulitzer without making it to Broadway. Jackson, who's a graduate of Cass Technical High School in Detroit, joins us now. Michael, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It is so crushing to have learned this news that you won the Pulitzer for a play that so many Americans will not have a chance to see for a while. What has this been like for you?
I keep saying this like in interviews that I do. I feel like I'm Samuel Beckett from Quantum Leap. I keep like going from dimension to dimension, trying to get back home. And it's like every day is like a new sort of adventure. I'm in this pandemic mode one moment in the world and craziness and the darkness of that. And then like I get like this great news about this award. And then that takes me sort of emotionally into like a different space. And that's really exciting. And it's just like that constant traveling back and forth. But it's been great.
The show A Strange Loop comes out of the gate reminding us that as much as queer history is tied up in Broadway, there are certain kinds of queerness, black queerness, for example, that have not had the same treatment. And then the show proceeds to give us a narrative that imagines what that might look like in the persona of a young queer black man with the, I guess, utterly bankable name of Disney Usher. that's kind of a genius moniker for what you're doing here, and it seems like the kind of references that have been important to you.
Yeah, you know, this piece is, I don't think of it as autobiographical as much as self-referential.
Yeah.
Early on, I sort of decided that I needed to give myself some distance from being like, this is a story about my life, because I knew that it wasn't totally that. It was like a perception of life. As a younger person, there was a lot I was trying to figure out. It wasn't until I was much older that I had some distance from like sort of the struggles of my youth. Once I had that objectivity, it was like, this character is not Michael, but it's like a perception of Michael. And that perception of Michael is another person who has a famous name.
Usher has a job that goes right along with his name as well. So people are always yelling at him, Usher.
Right, exactly.
And he's a different kind of protagonist than a lot of theater goers have seen before. Could you tell us a little bit about the actor who originated the role, Larry Owens?
The actor who originated the role was Larry Owens, who was someone who I met through the Musical Theater Factory, which is a musical theater development hub here in New York City. And he sort of like raised his hand for the part at a point when I was still figuring out what it was. I kind of can't talk totally about him without talking about like the entire cast, just because it's seven principals are in the piece, and they sort of all inform the sort of tone and the sonic world of it. And so he was just sort of one of many colors in sort of trying to tell this story about selfhood and Black queer selfhood.
The other cast members that you say are sort of a Greek chorus playing many roles that reflect interior monologues for Usher, as well as other real-life characters that you need them to portray.
Yeah, the other characters are Usher's thoughts. And so, though Usher is the protagonist of the show, his thoughts, they're mirroring back on him, and he's mirroring back on the thoughts, which is why I it's always important to me to stress that the show is, in fact, about these sort of seven Black queer bodies on stage. And they are there to, like, express like his deepest sort of desires and self-hatred and his humor, his critique of, you know, culture, of Black culture, of white culture, of white theater culture, of like, it's just every sort of thought that makes up who he is as a person. They sort of make up all of that, and all those things make up him.
There's a lyric in one of the songs called Today, and it goes, I hate days like today, days when I face myself.
Days when I face myself, but see the same reflection. Someone who's stuck rewriting and stuck in his own way. Someone who has to edit every imperfection today.
Could you talk a little bit about the tension between the joys of reinventing oneself and the feeling that we may not be sure if we want to change ourselves in ways that might smooth over our rough spots?
If I talk about my own experience, as a young person, I was just like so convinced every day was like such a struggle and a challenge to feel like I belonged in the world. And so I would always give myself these little challenges to like see if I could somehow win the day, and inevitably I would fail, you know, because like I was always setting myself up for these like incredibly high bars. And the reason why I was doing that all came from the same place, is that I felt that I wasn't enough, and that something was wrong with me that needed to be fixed. And this idea, I think, that something is wrong with you is something that probably a lot of people can relate to on some level, even if they don't name it, because like there's all these things that you do in your life that are you sort of betraying your own integrity or your own boundaries, just because you think that if you do it, that it's going to prove something greater about yourself. And so Usher had to get to a place in the piece of realizing that nothing was wrong with him. And in that moment is when he actually does change.
When you were coming up in Detroit, you were really involved in the Inside Out Literary Arts program. Could you talk a little bit about how that shaped the direction of your writing?
Yeah, it was really important because I was a student at Cass Tech in Detroit, and my creative writing teacher, Ms. Thompson, immediately, you know, brought in Inside Out into our school, and we got to work with writers in residence. And I kept creative writing as my elective for all 4 years of high school. And so I got to work with, like, all these writers in residence, one of which was this guy named Peter Marcus. And he really challenged me to push the boundaries of what I was writing about, because up until that point, I was kind of, like, trying to copy Maya Angelou. And I love Maya Angelou, but, like, I had a lot that was going on inside of me. I was, like, coming to terms with the fact that I was gay. And, like, a lot of that writing sort of germinated in Pete's class as a result of Inside Out. And Inside Out also let me see all these writers writing professionally. And I think it was the thing that, like, in addition to talking to my queer writing teacher and saying to her, like, do you think it's a pie in the sky idea to want to be a writer professionally? And she said, no, that like was just what I needed to hear as, like, an impressionable teenager to decide that I was going to pursue writing professionally in some way.
The musical is so inventive and has some experimental elements to it. Is there a through line from the way you started thinking about creative writing at that time to the form that we now see in this Pulitzer winning play?
Well, I think definitely in terms of content in one way, because, like, I started writing this piece as a monologue initially. I didn't think it was going to become a musical. I was about 21 years old and I was about to graduate from college, and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life with a playwriting degree. And I was writing a lot about what it felt like to be a young Black gay man who thought life was terrible. And in many ways, that mindset was reflecting back on when I was, like, a teenager and sort of also struggling internally with, like, how to be in the world. The music of it evolved in lots of different ways because, I didn't know that it was going to become a musical. So, like, a lot of the music comes from, you know, I grew up playing at church for choirs. I, like, had a deep obsession with Tori Amos's music that I do to this day. Like, I took those influences. I took the sort of gospel music influences that, you know, I grew up with, the Motown, the Philadelphia sound, like all that 70s sort of soul music, that's in there. Like, and then I went and studied musical theater at NYU's graduate musical theater writing program. All those elements, because this show is about this protagonist sort of writing himself into existence, everything that was influencing me was also influencing him and his creations and my creations.
What does it mean to have this musical, which is so centered around insecurities and feelings of being an outsider, to see that narrative win a Pulitzer?
It confirms that what I sort of had been doing all along was the right thing to do, because I never thought that this musical would ever be produced. And then it was. But in the gap when I thought it wasn't going to be produced, I just was like, well, since it'll never be produced, I can just write it however I want. I can be as honest, I can be as daring, I can be as truthful, and I should be as possible. And that sort of integrity, I think, really served the piece, because I was never censoring or editing myself with how much I would say the unsayable. And so I felt like when I got the Pulitzer, like, the culture had responded to just the truthfulness of the piece, which I think all theater should celebrate anyway, like truthfulness, just like being honest.
Yeah.
Not trying to, like, appeal to the masses or to be cute, you know, like to just say what you mean what you say. And, like, A Strange Loop is very much a say what you mean what you say piece.
And let the world make of it what it will.
Yes, and you don't have to like it. And that's something that, like, is, you know, a really important thing for me. I don't think that everyone has to like everything.
Right.
And you should have a choice to, like, come to it on your own terms and meet it wherever you are. You know, and that was very much how we approach the production as well, because, like, some might have thought, oh, this is like this very black queer piece, and so you have to kind of try to make it appeal to that audience. But I sort of realized, you know, getting ready for the production is like, no, there's something for everyone to learn about this black queer person, and yet that specificity contains universality. And I wanted to invite the audience to lean in and to care about what was happening.
You make no bones in the play about your own dislike for Tyler Perry's work. And it's funny to hear you say that you also did not want to write something that would be, that was written to be acceptable to an audience in the way that Tyler Perry writes to a certain audience. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Well, yeah, and it's like really funny because he actually called me
the other day. No, he did not. Really?
He really did.
What was that conversation like?
It was a short but respectful, short and respectful conversation. He said that he was going to beat my but that he also congratulated me on winning the Pulitzer. and he like wanted to know about the historical nature of the win and like, you know, it was short and sweet. I encouraged him to buy the cast album, which he did, because he had not seen the show. He only had heard about it. And I just have to be like really clear about this, because in the show, Usher has a distaste for Tyler Perry's work for various reasons.
In no small part because his parents love Tyler Perry and don't understand why he can't write a show like Tyler Perry's shows.
Right, but like the thing of it is that like, the issue with Tyler Perry's work is more to do with the actual content and craft of it. And Usher and I are people who care deeply about how things are made. And it's not just that like, oh, this is something that's popular and makes a lot of money, so therefore it must be good. And that's something that I think is like a very pervasive idea in our culture that I find very bothersome and loathsome. I'm not one of those people who like is so high-minded and bougie about who he's writing for or the fact that he writes broad comedies or anything of that nature. It's just that like I feel like it just needs to be done well and it needs to make sense.
Did your heart just like go through the floor when you realized that he was calling you?
Not exactly. Just because since, you know, this piece got produced, it was almost like the piece became magnetized and all these sort of people who I had idolized or loved from afar or whatever sort of came to it. So when he called me, it just felt like this is the moment when, like, after all these years of this song, Tyler Perry writes for life existing in this musical, finally, he hears about it. Because all during the show, when I would do talkbacks, people would be like, does Tyler Perry know about this? Does Tyler Perry know about this? Have you heard from him? Are you scared? And I was like, no, I'm not scared. I mean, I have a critique, and I'm, like, making it. And that should be fine. Like, the fact that I even have a critique, I think, says that his work is of some importance.
Yeah.
And the truth of it is, like, the song Tyler Perry writes for life is literally about Usher saying to his agent, ew, I don't like Tyler Perry's work and I don't want to write for him. And then the ancestors rising up out of their graves to admonish Usher and say that he's an idiot.
All these icons of black culture.
Yeah, like Harriet Tubman and Whitney Houston and all these people rise up out of their graves to be like, are you insane? And like, who do you think you are to thumb your nose at this important black man who is writing these stories for black people?
Because Tyler Perry writes real life. Tyler Perry writes real life. He writes stories we can swallow like Popeye's chicken and biscuits.
So like, in a weird way, the song actually honors him, though the satire of it makes it clear what Usher's perspective is.
You know, I could go on with you for hours. The play is amazing. I did want to ask, both your parents still live in Detroit and you're in mm-hmm. New York. And I just wanted to sort of check in and see what it's like for your family navigating this moment right now. Both cities have been hit so hard by the virus.
Yeah. So, I mean, luckily my family has been very safe. I did have two relatives who were affected by COVID, but they're both now recovered and fine. My parents are, you know, in the house I grew up in. And I, you know, I'm in New York. I know a lot of people here in New York who have gotten sick. But again, thankfully, they've all recovered or on their way to recovery. And so my little world so far is okay. My parents are on cloud nine about the Pulitzer and about the show. They saw it and they loved it. It's been really exciting to watch the joy that they get out of this.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in the theatrical community have sort of been celebrating my win as their win. And I truly just, I love that. That to me is one other layer to this that makes this whole experience like more bearable.
Well, Michael R. Jackson, thank you so much for talking with us and congratulations. We can't wait for the time when this can be produced more widely and we can see even more of your work.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
Michael R. Jackson is the author of A Strange Loop, which took a Pulitzer this year for achievement in drama. Coming up on the show, dam failures in Midland County this week lead to historic floods in a region that's home to several chemical manufacturers and contaminated sites. We'll discuss the long-term environmental impact of the floods next on Stateside. Please stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit every doorstep of every home in every part of the world. But the reality is some cities are harder hit than others. That includes Detroit. The devastation here at home caught the attention of frontline workers everywhere. And two registered nurses at a hospital in Austin, Texas, decided to do more. Married couple Leo and Rocio Nunez traveled to Detroit and spent 2 weeks working at a hospital here with a surge of COVID-19 patients. Their story was filed by KUT in Austin.
At the beginning of our arrival, every floor was a COVID-positive floor. And at least on the hospital where we were, this is a 7-story high hospital with about 20 units. Every unit has maybe 30, 40 beds. So just can you imagine how many people were sick on that place? And it was all ages. This virus didn't have a specific demographic. We got to see from elder people to the young people that were healthy prior to acquiring the virus, healthcare workers, just, you know, people that were even just minding their business. They just got sick and they didn't even realize they were sick.
Yeah, things were moving fast. People were going in and out of rooms. In every room, I pretty much saw half of the people on ventilators. Like, the hallways were filled with crash carts, meds, ventilators. So there wasn't much room to walk through, but it just gives you a glimpse of, my gosh, how much things do we need? I mean, the good thing about all this was that all the workers there, from the janitor up to the doctors, they were getting the proper amount of PPE. So there was a room full of personal protective equipment, which is really nice because, I mean, you heard that there was a shortage and you know, in order to do your job, you just can't be scared of going in there with
what
you
unprepared. That was one of the biggest shocks. My first night was a night to remember. You put on an N95, and then you put on a surgical mask. You put on your goggles, your shield, your hairnet, your shoe covers, plastic gown, and then go take care of one patient inside of the room. You try to make sure you don't forget anything because now at this time you are completely covered. And then you start doing things and you're sweating. You're under all this plastic. You feel your neck drenched. You feel like you're short of breath because of how much things you put in to secure your airway. So can you imagine? I was undressed for 30 minutes at most. My nose was sore. Around my face, you could see the marks from having the mask very tight on my face. And just at the end of my shift, the first thing that I said to the nurse that was training me is, I don't have a hat, but I take my hat off to you because just doing the work itself is hard. Having to do it under all that plastic makes it 100 times harder. the deployment, it was pretty hard. During the night, you will hear code blue for this, code blue for that. Patients were declining very fast. Patients that looked like they were doing okay and stable will be declining overnight to where some of them didn't make it overnight.
They started this team called the end of life team to work 24/7, day shift and a night shift. Our role was to go inside the COVID positive patient's room, depending on their acuity, if they were getting worse. And then they would give us a tablet. So what we would do, we would FaceTime the patients with the family members. So the family members can see their loved ones, talk to them. And then if things got worse, once the patient passed away, we went in there with a tablet again, and we were there next to the patient. Families would be able to say their goodbyes. That was the sad part in all this, but in all, I think getting to know the patients and the patients, family members, and letting them know, hey, your family member is not alone in this hospital. I understand you're not allowed to come here, but don't worry, there's all of us are here next to him. He or she is not alone. I mean, if only people here that are don't understand and, you know,
you haven't seen it, experience it.
Haven't seen the experience. I want to take them to that place. People's diagnosis was going from good to worse in a matter of hours. It just opened up a reality of this is bad. How can we stop it? Why can we tell people be careful, be more open-minded about washing your hands, be more precautions? And pretty much that's what I left with, knowing I helped out with what I could, but at the same time, we have never been hit this hard in my lifetime. So I hope people take it as a learning experience and are grateful for the little things they have now.
I'm more cautious. I am more cautious, and I'm definitely still not coming out to the new open city yet. I have seen how fast this virus takes somebody's life. From a person just getting admitted 3 hours ago to now they're on a respirator to now they were calling the family to say that their family members, it's gone. So we're taking the extra precautions every day, and we continue working right now, but we are taking the extra precautions, and we're taking the time now to educate people. So my role now, I feel like, is more of the teach and share my experience, and hopefully we don't get to the same stage that Detroit did.
That was Leo and Rocio Nunez of Austin, Texas. Their story came to us from KUT, the public radio station in Austin. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Downtown Midland is knee-deep in water today, and Wixom Lake is empty, just drained, as if the stopper was pulled out of the sink basin. In some ways, it was. 48 hours of heavy rains caused two dams on the Tittabawassee River to fail. 10,000 people left their homes, and at this point, no one knows when it's going to be safe to go back. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelson filed this story from Midland.
Shelter organizers at Midland High School are being really careful. This is where some of the oldest and frailest residents of the flooded city have been evacuated. Cots are 6 feet apart. Nearly everyone's wearing masks. Pat Wood is sitting in the gymnasium with two friends who live in the same senior citizen complex. She didn't sleep well.
I slept on that cot and I had leg cramps all night. So I just get up and walk around.
Luckily, she now has a mattress. and she's being spoiled by eager volunteers, along with donations of Starbucks coffee, food, blankets, kitty litter, you name it.
So in fact, we'd like to stay. And if we become homeless, this wouldn't be too bad.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer dropped by the school after an aerial tour of the city. Devastating, she says.
It's hard to believe that we're in the midst of a 100-year crisis, a global pandemic, and that we're also dealing with a flooding event that looks to be the worst in 500 years.
Whitmer pledged to find out why the dams failed. The first one that failed had its license revoked in 2018 after federal regulators say it was chronically non-compliant with needed upgrades. The company, Boyce Hydro, was negotiating the sale of the dam when it failed.
Because this incredible damage requires that we hold people responsible, and we are pursuing and going to pursue every line of legal recourse that we can.
There's been no public response from the operator of the dam. The city of Midland is the home of Dow Chemical. The company has a chemical plant alongside the river. It says floodwaters commingled with materials in containment ponds, but it says there were no releases and there's no threat to people or the environment. Brad Kay is Midland city manager. He says he understands. People want to head back home. Don't, he says.
This is not over. So don't let up. Don't take it easy at this point in time. Don't think we're done and that we're past the peak, because we simply are not at that point.
City officials say Midland floods a lot, but it's not accustomed to dams failing. Ann Jefferson is a hydrologist at Kent State University. She says the two dams that failed are nearly 100 years old. Moreover,
our infrastructure was designed for a past climate, and we know that climate has changed and climate is continuing to change. And that means these more intense rainfalls and wetter conditions overall are things that our infrastructure wasn't designed for.
City officials say they can't predict when the floodwaters will recede. It will be a hard homecoming for many, though, dealing with a disaster within a disaster. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton.
The flooding in Midland caused by the two failed dams has taken a toll on homes and property. But here's a longer-lasting and perhaps ultimately greater concern. Any flood of this magnitude carries contaminants and debris with it downstream. Midland is home to chemical manufacturing, as well as other potentially hazardous sites. The Environment Report's Lester Graham has been looking into some of those risks, and he joins us now. Hi, Lester.
Hi there.
What kind of risks are we talking about here?
Well, there are a lot of them, but let's start with the longstanding problem along the Tittabawassee, and that's dioxin pollution. In the past, Dow's chemical complex dumped dioxin directly into the river, and then when it was discovered that dioxin was actually hazardous to public health, that became a real concern. The World Health Organization indicates dioxins are highly toxic, can cause reproductive and developmental problems, damage the immune system, interfere with hormones, and also cause cancer. Now, there was this decades-long battle between Dow regulators in Michigan, who were often sympathetic to Dow, and the U.S. EPA. We did a series clear back in 2009 about the ridiculous amount of time it took to come to an agreement, and it's still not fully implemented. This massive flood might actually undo some of that remediation. I talked to Nathan Murphy. He's the state director of the group Environment Michigan.
I fully expect that that's going to resuspend some of those contaminated sediments from the river channel and put those back into the floodplains, just like it's historically done. That was what created the floodplain dioxin levels that required cleanup, that created wildlife eating advisories. And I'm very concerned that these high waters will put more dioxin-contaminated sediment back onto those floodplains.
That original cleanup project, that stretched more than 50 miles along the Tittabawassee and Saginaw Rivers.
Man, that sounds really bad. But what does it mean for the people who actually live along the rivers?
So I think what it means is people who finally got dioxin-contaminated soil removed from their backyards in recent years, they might come home to find that their yards are contaminated once again.
Well, that's one concern for sure, but we are talking about contamination from the past. Are there sources that we think we should be thinking about right now that present-day operations might cause in this flood?
Possibly. One of the issues is stored hazardous waste and other kinds of waste. A Dow facility and a Dow Corning facility, both near the river, are listed by the U.S. EPA as, quote, significant non-compliers of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. That's also called RCRA. It regulates how hazardous and non-hazardous waste should be handled. In a Facebook post, Dow Chemical confirmed there were floodwaters commingling with an on-site containment pond used for stormwater and brine system groundwater remediation. Now, I looked up what chemicals might be in those settling ponds. That list was 26 pages long. Our colleague Dustin Dwyer found the contingency plan that was approved by the state indicated the containment pond was to be protected against a 100-year flood. But, you know, with climate change, the state might have to reconsider its protection standards for flooding.
That's our colleague Dustin Dwyer, a reporter based out of Grand Rapids. So, Lester, you're saying we know for sure that the containment pond has been breached?
Well, Dow calls it commingled, but, you know, it's going to be an issue regardless. I mean, there are a lot of different chemicals that went in there, including solvents, tars, lead, other heavy metals, fluorine, phosgene. It just goes on and on and on. Nathan Murphy at Environment Michigan feels there are greater concerns beyond that that we don't know anything about.
If you look at our accidents waiting to happen report that we have up on our website, only New Jersey requires facilities to report everything they've got on site rather than just the waste. And what we found from just the New Jersey data is they have a lot more material that could be really hazardous pollution that's sitting on their site being stored for them to use.
They, when you say they, who do you mean? Any chemical manufacturer or any manufacturer?
Well, any facility that has those sorts of chemicals that could result in toxic pollution that would require some sort of reporting under RCRA.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no reason to think that Michigan companies or Michigan facilities are significantly different than those in New Jersey. And that suggests there's probably a really substantial volume of potentially really scary chemicals sitting on that Dow site with water encroaching closer and closer.
Now, on a post on Facebook, Dow stated there have been no reported product releases. And I should say we called Dow and asked for an interview, but we haven't heard back from the company.
Lester, hold on a second here. Why don't state regulators know what kind of materials or chemicals are stored at industrial sites?
Well, that's a really good question. If it's anything like why we don't know what's in fracking fluids, for example, it's because businesses say those ingredients are proprietary. They don't want competitors to know what they use to make their products. And Nathan Murphy at Environment Michigan thinks that's a real risk.
You know, we do have communities that are potentially exposed to these chemicals, and we don't know what those chemicals might be. And the regulated industry is politically powerful enough that they can continue to prevent our communities from finding out.
And the only way that's going to change is to change the laws in Michigan.
I'm guessing at that point, we're talking about consequences for companies beyond just Dow, right?
Right.
Okay, so what other kinds of businesses or industrial sites should we keep in mind for Midland and Mid-Michigan?
I mean, it could be something as simple as a landscaper's business that might get flooded. There are going to be some chemicals stored there. In an email, the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy indicated it's also concerned about gas stations or other places where they store liquid and solid waste that are now underwater. It stated it'll have a better idea of any real contamination when all that water recedes, and that's going to be a few days.
Mm-hmm. Geez, Lester, if I didn't know better with all of this, I'd say you were maybe just trying to freak me out.
Yeah, you know, I'm really not. It's just these are genuine concerns, and there's another thing that we found out, and it might not be of any concern at all. But again, Dustin Dwyer looked this up, and he found that Dow has a nuclear reactor in Midland. Now, I checked it out. It's a small research TRIGA reactor, which is used at universities and commercial operations across the nation. It's really small, and they're considered very safe. But we don't know exactly where that nuclear reactor is located, other than it's in Midland someplace. So how close it is to the river, we don't know.
Lester Graham hosts the Environment Report for Michigan Radio and reports for us for environmental issues now and again. Lester, thank you very much for checking on all this for us.
Good to talk to you, April.
Tomorrow on Stateside, Memorial Day weekend usually means marching band parades, trips to the beach, family barbecues, while, as we heard earlier, the governor has eased some restrictions on small gatherings. Health experts say caution is still important. We'll be speaking with an epidemiologist with some recommendations tomorrow. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.